أن هذه أحكام الأنبياء.
I bear testimony that what I saw today are the rulings brought by the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says, أمير المؤمنين قدمني إلى قاضيه وقاضيه يقضى عليه. He says, the chief of the believers takes me to a judge who is appointed by him, and the judge rules against him. This is where we see the sense of justice, and this is where he says, you know, this is definitely coming from the ahkam of the Anbiya. ثم أسلم. He became a Muslim there. It wasn't an issue of this armor that Ali was looking for. He became a Muslim. اعترف بأن الدرع سقطت من علي عند مصيره إلى صفين. And he confessed that this was an armor which fell down from Ali's horse in his journey towards Siffin, and I picked it up later on. So even he knew this was, you know, Ali's property. ففرح علي عليه السلام بإسلامه. Imam became very pleased with his Islam, gave him the armor, plus as a bonus, a horse with it. And this fellow became a companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen and fought alongside him against the Khawarij and became one of the shuhada in the way of Islam and in the way of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Iran's assistance has been pivotal to the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist colonial occupation. And in the first part of today's programme, we'll be looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran's role in supporting the liberation of Palestine. In the second half of the show, we'll be examining how Palestine's resistant factions themselves view Iran's role in their struggle for freedom. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra setting out the extent to which Iran supports Palestinian liberation.
As the Palestinian resistance factions increasingly come together and take the fight to the Zionist entity, what kind of support are they getting from outside? Even its worst enemies recognise that since its establishment in 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has become a leading patron of the Palestinian cause. Those are the words of the Zionist front group United Against Nuclear Iran. They are quite correct. How has Iran supported the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian? Earlier this year, tens of thousands of Iranians have taken part in the annual Quds Day rallies in the capital, Tehran, in a major show of support for Palestine. Similar marches and events happen in more than 900 cities and villages nationwide, according to officials. Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, who was the keynote speaker of the event in Tehran, told the gathering crowd that Iran's first supreme leader, Ruhollah Khomeini, established Quds Day shortly after the 1979 revolution to let the world know that Palestine was not alone. He said the current supreme leader, Ali Husseini Khamenei, subsequently established the Quds Force, the overseas arm of IRGC, to expand the Islamic revolution in other Islamic countries with the aim of pressuring the Zionist regime, and in the near future, the regime's elimination from the world's political geography. Even the Jerusalem Post recognizes the strategy being adopted by Iran of unifying the resistance, a strategy which is visibly now in operation. In the Unity Intifada of May 2021, it was revealed on the Lebanese news service Al-Manar that a joint operation room was established in Beirut in response to the Zionist attacks on Gaza. It involved officers from Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The commander of IRGC's Al-Quds force, General Ismail Qani, visited Lebanon twice to attend the meetings. The Palestinian factions were provided with data about the movement of the Israeli occupation military, which frustrated the enemy's plot to ambush the Palestinian fighters near the Gaza border. According to the editor-in-chief of the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar, Ibrahim Al-Amin said, "Had Israel expanded its aggression, the entire axis of resistance would have confronted it." Amongst the other support from Iran is funding, weapons and training. In 2020, Al Jazeera broadcast revelations from Hamas about the weapons being supplied by Iran. The program What is Hidden is Greater showed members of Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, collecting Iranian Fajr missiles and Cornet anti-tank shells. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands fully behind the Palestinian faction and is central to the wider axis of resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Sami Ramadani. Sami is an Iraqi-born lecturer in sociology, and he writes on Iraq and current affairs of the Middle East. He's also a member of the steering committee of the Stop the War Coalition. Sami was a political exile from Saddam's regime, but he actively opposed the US-led sanctions on Iraq and campaigned against the invasion and occupation of his homeland. Welcome to the show. David, what can you tell us about United Against Nuclear Iran, and should we listen to their assessment, do you think?
Well, United Against Nuclear Iran is one of the most pro-Israel think tanks in the US. Mm. I mean, it really should be registered as a foreign agent of the Zionist entity, but it's not. But it has on its board people who used to be the director of Mossad, and it's really quite kind of out there as a kind of extreme supporter of Israel. But nevertheless, they recognise that the role which Iran plays. And so, you know, it's interesting that even an organisation as ultra-Zionist as that is able to say something about how Iran relates to Palestinian liberation, and it's an accurate statement. Mm. And even though this is a hyper-Zionist organisation.
Well, Sami, I mean, tell us about the history of Iranian support for the Palestinians.
I think 1979 obviously is the critical year, because that's when the Iranian Revolution overthrew the Shah's regime. And the Shah's regime was a cornerstone of Israeli Zionist presence in the area. The Iranian regime under the Shah acted as Israel's main ally in the region. And the Iranian Revolution dealt a heavy blow to Zionist presence in the area, and put a halt, at least, to a lot of the aggressive policies that the Zionist leaders were planning in the region.
What does this daily coordination in Beirut tell us about the relations with the resistance and Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, the fact that they've got this daily war room where they're actually planning joint operations, not just between the Islamic Republic and the Palestinian factions, all of the factions, but also with Hezbollah. It shows that they actually conceive of the axis of resistance as being a functioning organizational body. And of course, it encompasses also groups in Iraq and in Yemen and in Syria. So, but it does show that there's an actual functioning axis of resistance, which effectively has its own governance structures. And that's an indication of the unity that there is now against the Zionist entity, and the fact that it's looking increasingly difficult for Israel to continue its activities.
Mm. I mean, Sami, I mean, can you explain what this term axis of resistance means?
It obviously evolved after the Iranian Revolution of 79. And basically it includes the various Palestinian resistance groups, Hezbollah in Lebanon. And later, obviously, as states, this term became to include Syria, and some Iraqi organizations, as well as, of course, Iran. And nowadays, you can even include the resistance of the Yemeni people against Saudi aggression.
I mean, and the resistance, of course, is seemingly, from the outside, becoming more effective than I think it's been in the past. I mean, would you agree with that, Sami?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there were some decisive moments, especially within the context of the two arenas, and a third one, I'll explain that as well. The first is the presence of Hezbollah in Lebanon, which actually defeated the Israeli occupation forces and defeated new aggressions on southern Lebanon and on Beirut and Lebanon in general by the Israeli forces. So that these events, these great military victories, became axiomatic or extremely important to the development of resistance against Israeli occupations and aggressions. And the second arena is Gaza, of course, and Palestine in general. Or if you like, this is the first one because it preceded the resistance in Lebanon. And the heroic, incredible resistance of the people of Gaza, for example, Palestinian people in Gaza, is incredible because Gaza is just one big prison occupied by Israel, surrounded sea, land, and air by Israeli occupation, is quite a remarkable form of resistance. So this is and in the last, say, since 2011, there also evolved resistance within Syria against the terrorist organizations that attempted to divide and destroy Syria completely.
Let me just ask David a question, if I can, before we go to the next clip that we want to show you. I mean, I just wanted to ask you, David, I mean, what do you say to the people who've been claiming that Iran and Syria, for that matter, actually, are not really anti-imperialist countries at all?
Well, there's no purity in struggle. I mean, in reality, there is the imperial power, which is the US and its allies, and the UK and Israel, and there is the opposition to that. And the opposition to that is the anti-imperialist cause. And people say, well, they're not left-wing enough. They're not like Venezuela or Cuba. That's not anti-imperialism. But, of course, anti-imperialism has got nothing at all to do with the question of neoliberalism. It's a question of whether you actively are in supporting the resistance. And if you ask the resistance what they think, they say, yes, Iran is our ally.
Well, we'll just pause there for a moment because we've got a report now about how the resistance in Palestine actually views Iran.
The commitment of the Islamic Republic to the liberation of Palestine is not metaphorical or emotional. It is a clear material relationship that can be traced through the statements of both friends and enemies. Those who question Iran's selfless support for Palestine need only review the statements made by the resistance factions themselves for clarity. The generous support the Islamic Republic has given Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad is well known. What is less well known is the support it has given to both Fatah and the PFLP. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, founded in 1967 by George Habash, has struggled long and hard for liberation from Zionist colonialism and achieved some considerable victories. Just 21 years ago, the PFLP carried out the assassination of the highest-ranking Israeli minister by any Palestinian group throughout the struggle. The Israeli Minister of Tourism, Rehavim Zeevi, was tracked to a hotel in occupied Al-Quds and liquidated by PFLP operatives. The action was taken in response to the Israeli murder of PFLP leader Abu Ali Mustafa. As Talal Naji, the PFLP's Secretary General, revealed in an interview, Iran supplied all the Palestinian resistant factions, including Fatah, with weapons transported by ship. Naji claimed that while many know about the famous Karine A ship, which was stopped by the Israeli from transporting weapons to Fatah, most do not know about the 9 other ships that got through. He then asserts that in order for the factions in Gaza to develop their own means of resistance, the guidance of the late Qasem Soleimani was vital in developing the methods through which the factions produce their own rockets. Prior to this taking place, Naji makes clear how limited the capabilities were. The training to develop these means would take place in the Islamic Republic, Syria, or Lebanon under the supervision of Qasem Soleimani. Talal Naji states it was Soleimani who personally oversaw the delivery of the Hornet rocket, a Russian anti-tank missile, to Gaza. These rockets allowed the resistance to shock the Israelis by destroying their Merkavat tanks in 2009. Talal Naji later added, were it not for the principled support and positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the victories of the axis of resistance in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen would not have happened today. Israel has consistently accused the Islamic Republic of supporting Palestinian resistance factions as if it was a bad thing, guilty as charged. Despite relentless conspiracy against it, the axis of resistance still stands.
Sami, you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, but I just wondered if you could give us a brief outline of the different Palestinian factions that were mentioned in that clip we've just watched.
The two, if you like, historically most important organizations that appeared on the scene in terms of organized resistance. The very first one was Fatah, which was, it started military operations in 1965, January 1965, in fact. So Fatah became the largest resistance organization, followed closely later on by the establishment of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And there are other organizations, obviously, but the, if you like, the most important addition to these groups was the emergence of Hamas in the early 80s as a military and political force. And Hamas gradually grew and became much bigger, and Gaza became the center of activity and organization, and its leadership emerged, or rather consolidated their presence in Gaza. So if you like, these are the three most important organizations representing various political trends within the Palestinian people, but with a common objective of liberation of Palestine and of continuing resistance. Sometimes there are tactical differences about forms of resistance, but there is broad agreement, strategic agreement, about the liberation of Palestine and resistance to Zionist occupation and aggression. And these organizations had various levels of relations, whether with Hezbollah or with Iran or even with Syria, because Syria for few decades, actually, Damascus was a major center for supporting Palestinian resistance. And although it became, obviously, the Syrian state became heavily involved to protect Syria itself. And let us not forget that Syrian lands are also occupied by Israel, the Golan Heights, very strategic, very important area of Syria. So you have an emergence of commonality of interest against Israeli aggression and occupation, and Iran became a major ally of that scene.
Yeah. David, I wonder whether you could say, or indeed, what you make of the Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Talal Naji, what he said in that segment. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's perfectly clear, isn't it, that that all of the factions are being supported by the Iranians. It's not just the one which is perceived to be closest to them, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but all of the factions. And it's also clear that there's much more in the way of support going on than is publicly known about. So sometimes we see ships are seized or materials are stopped. But clearly, there's lots of other material which is getting through. Yes, by sea, but also by land as well. So there's clearly a massive operation going on there, and the Israelis have been a bit surprised and shocked by that sometimes, and especially in the Unity Intifada of last May, where they were preparing for a ground operation and ground invasion of Gaza, and they discovered they couldn't do it, and they pulled back, and there was a ceasefire. So there's a real balance going on here, which people perhaps don't realise.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, Sami, it's not well known that Iran also armed Fatah, is it? And what do you think that says about the wider policy of the Islamic Republic towards Palestine?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, because it dates back to 1979, and in 79, Fatah by far was the largest Palestinian resistance organization, and their leader went to Tehran straight away. And there, from there on, they built very, very close relations between Fatah and Iran. And Iran, as soon as they could, started supporting materially Fatah. And later on, the PFLP, and later on, Hamas, and later on, Islamic Jihad, which is a much smaller organization within Gaza, but in recent years it has become a much stronger force, and perhaps ideologically very close to Iran as well, more closer than others on other issues to do with the religion, to do with the perspectives about resistance and revolution and so on. But broadly speaking, all these organizations, and centrally Fatah initially, was quite an important link between the Palestinian people's struggle and Iran, as expressed by the then Fatah leaders themselves and the Iranian leaders too. So it's a broad scene, and it indicates as well that Iran has a certain political, ideological position on Palestine, yeah, as well as a religious perspective and so on. But in terms of the broad political approach, they regard Palestine as central to the struggle of the peoples of the region, as well as the Iranian people themselves, that yeah, the arena of Palestine is vital for the struggle of the Iranian people themselves and their struggle for independence. Remember, I mean, Iran is such a massive strategic state in the whole region, and this state became independent of U.S. domination in the region. And yeah, U.S. domination.
Let me just move on to David now, because I just want to get David's thoughts about a recent interview. The leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad commented that Hamas receives a lion's share of Iran's support to Palestinians. I mean, I wonder how you think that might confound expectations.
Well, as Sammy was saying, I mean, both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are later on the scene than the previous organisations, more secular organisations. But Palestinian Islamic Jihad is much smaller. It's perceived as being much closer to the Islamic Republic, and therefore people, I think, imagine that they get almost all of the aid that the Iranians get. But no, on the contrary, it's Hamas which gets the bulk of the aid because it's the largest military force. But what we see, I think, increasingly, is a kind of blurring of the lines between these different factions. And with the recent attacks that there have been and the recent activities that have been in the West Bank, especially the appearance of the Lion's Den and various other Palestinian resistance groups, you see even groups, fighters from Fatah involved in the Lion's Den, along with fighters from Palestinian Islamic Jihad or from Hamas. So there's a real sense in which those lines of difference are blurring.
Mm. Very briefly, Sammy, because we're almost out of time, I just wonder whether you could say what price you think the Islamic Republic pays for its steadfast support for the resistance.
I think it's a massive price, really, to be accurate about what's going on. The Iranian state has been subjected to massive opposition from imperialism led by the United States and regionally by Israel and some of the Arab regimes as well. So one of the main reasons why the United States and Israel are so opposed to Iran and try to punish Iran is the stance on Palestine. So part of one of the most important reasons for the sanctions, for example, is support for Palestine, and by extension as well, support for Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is an anti-Israeli force, support for Syria, because Syria's lands are occupied by Israel, and Israel supports terrorism in Syria. Also within an Iraqi context, Israel and the terrorist groups are extremely active within Iraq. They use Iraqi Kurdistan as a base against Iran. So on many fronts, the Iran is paying a heavy price, but they are proud of it at the same time. Politically, they say this is our politics, this is our ideology, this is how we want to conduct.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Sammy, because we're right out of time. I'm really sorry. We could go on for a lot longer, but I'd like to thank our guests today, Sammy Ramadani, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
British media have reported that 3 out of 7 tenants in England have seen their rent increases in the past few weeks or months. Also, the increasing trend of interbank interest rates in England, which is directly related to mortgage payments of millions of British households, means that the country is now facing a serious housing crisis. We'll take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website moneyweek.com has covered the story and tells us more. A leading British property company has reported the average monthly rent across Britain, excluding London, has hit a new record of £1,172 per month, as people are struggling to cope with the surging inflation and worsening cost of living crisis. Rightmove, a UK-based real estate company, said on its website on Friday, 27th of January, that tenants in London are being asked to fork out over twice that amount, with a typical private rent hitting as high as £2,480, a 5.8% increase from the previous quarter. James Reddington, sales and letting director at Douglas & Gordon, was at pains to say that. "We've seen the highest rent increases we've seen for decades, and we don't expect this to slow down in the short term." The website also warned of the rising gap between demand and supply, noting that more homes are getting available for rent as tenants cannot afford the renting costs. Rightmove said the number of available homes to rent in December of 2022 had increased by 13% compared with a year earlier, predicting that the average number of people asking for rents across Britain will rise by 5% in 2023. Unless there is a significant addition of available homes to rent. The average asking rent had already experienced a 7% rise in December of 2022. Rightmove's Director of Property Science, Tim Bannister, said, "Although the fierce competition among tenants to find a home is starting to ease, it is still double the level it was back in 2019. Tim Bannister added, "Letting agents are seeing extremely high volumes of tenant inquiries and dealing with tens of potential tenants for each available property. The simmering renting costs are not the only implication of the deteriorating economic situation across the United Kingdom. Energy and food prices, along with vital living costs, have experienced a sharp increase in recent months, as the United Kingdom is grappling with its decades-high inflation. Due to the worsening cost of living crisis and low wages, the labour forces in different industries have staged strikes across the country, paralysing the country's vital infrastructure, such as rail services and the healthcare system." British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Wales and south-west of England have seen the biggest jumps in new properties to rent, which used asking rents of properties listed on Rightmove to make the findings. Rightmove's Director of Property Science, Tim Bannister, said landlords will need to balance any rent rises with what tenants can afford to pay in their local area to continue to find tenants quickly and avoid any periods where their home is empty due to tenants not being able to meet the asking rent. He said, "There appears to be some more property choice for renters compared to the record low levels of last year, which would slightly ease the fierce competition to secure a home." Tim Bannister added, "This is why we're forecasting that the pace of annual growth will ease to around 5% by the end of the year nationally, although this would still significantly exceed the average of 2% that we saw during the 5 years before the pandemic." Simon Lee, director at Hackney and Lee Estate Agents and Letting Agents, said, "The rental market remains buoyant and the majority of our landlords are still receiving multiple applications on their properties." Simon Lee added, "Rents have remained stable due in part to the cautious approach from landlords when considering rent increases at renewal stage, preferring to retain good tenants rather than have even a small void period or incur the associated costs." According to a think tank, more than 2 in 5 or 44% working age households reported being either behind on or struggling with housing-related costs in November. According to the Resolution Foundation's figures, the proportion of those who have fallen behind or are struggling has jumped from 26% during the depths of the coronavirus pandemic in January of 2021. The latest survey found that while 6% of working-age households had fallen behind on their housing costs in November last year, a further 38% had met their costs but had struggled. The foundation suggested that while the COVID-19 crisis worsened housing stress, the current cost of living crisis has delivered a more extensive shock to British households. Researchers found 8% of private renters reported falling behind on housing costs in the 3 months leading up to November of 2022. Nearly a fifth, or 19%, of social renters reported falling behind with their housing costs, as did 4% of mortgage holders. Some of those surveyed owed their home outright. Many mortgage holders have not felt the immediate impacts of interest rates rising due to being on a fixed-rate mortgage deal, but they could see their costs increase when their current deal comes to an end. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has also covered the same story and tells us more. A former Bank of England bigwig warned of more pain to come for millions of British households from rising mortgage costs. Andy Haldane, who was the Bank of England's chief economist until 2021, predicted real wages would fall again this year because of the impact of punishingly high inflation. The Bank of England is forecast to hike its main interest rate from 3.5% to 4% next week to try to cool inflation. That will hit millions of borrowers with variable rate mortgages and those looking for new home loans. But Andy Haldane, now chief executive of the Royal Society of Arts, said, "It is painful and I fear there is more pain to come as those mortgage rate rises for the last year begin to hit people's bank accounts over this year." High Street Bank TSB recently announced it was setting aside £55 million for loans that might turn sour because of the worsening economy and the cost of living crisis. But the lender said it had yet to see a marked increase in customers experiencing financial difficulties or missing payments. Boss Robin Bullock said, "The resilience of customers is quite remarkable." Andy Haldane, interviewed on BBC Radio 4's Today programme, said, "The terrible double whammy of first COVID and then the cost of living crisis has and is causing huge amounts of financial stress for many businesses, for many households and, of course, for many charities." He added, "We've had a lost decade and a half in terms of pay rises in inflation-adjusted terms. Last year, we saw real pay fall, and we are most likely to see that same happen again this year, and that is putting acute financial stress and indeed mental stress on great many British households."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, It took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Well, we are talking about the rules about purity. Sheikh Javid, let me start this episode with this question. What is istibra? And is istibra obligatory to perform?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Istibra is a recommended act performed by man after urinating in order to be sure that no urine is left in the urethra. And of course, istibra is a desirable act. It is not obligatory for men. And it is recommended that men who urinate, they try to make the fluid left in the urethra leave the urinary passage. And of course, the object of istibra is to ensure that no more urine is left in the urethra. That's for sure. And there are certain ways of performing istibra, and the best of them is that after passing the urine, if the rectum is also made najis, first of all, the rectum is purified, or the excretory passage is purified with water, and then thereafter the part between the anus and the root of the penis should be pressed thrice with the middle finger of the left hand. And of course, the thumb is placed on the urinary or that the penis and the, it's pressed so that there is no fluid left in the passage. And of course, as I said,
and how many times should it be? Like once, or
it is said that it should be pressed thrice. But you know, there is no mandatory law about it. There is nothing obligatory. It's it is always recommended. It is mustahab. And of course, the object of istibra is to make sure that there is no urine left.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because otherwise it will create problem. Okay, one has to wash not only the urinary outlet, but also his underwear, because he cannot pray with mm-hmm. the urine on his body.
I see. Sheikh Javid, is it possible actually to do the istibra, purifying actually the urinary outlet and the anus with dalil water?
Well, that's a good question, because many people keep wondering as to whether qalil water or little water. But qalil is an Arabic word which means little.
Right.
So small amount, let's say a cup of water is qalil water.
Anything less than the core.
Yeah, anything less than the core is qalil water. So for purification of the urinary outlet with qalil water, it is necessary, of course, after removing the inherently najis material,
mm-hmm.
to wash it twice, because it is necessary to wash it twice. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. And we are using qalil water, and qalil water is used twice. Otherwise, if we are using cool water or running water, using cool water once is sufficient. And when it comes to qalil water, because the amount of water is very little in terms of quantity, then one has to wash the urinary outlet twice. And any part of the body which comes into contact with najasa, if one has to use qalil water, he has to wash it twice.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mahajal, the host in this program, Ashraf Javid, is still our guest speaker, talking about these rules and regulations and the Islamic laws related to tahara and purification. Sheikh Javid, you know, even after urination and doing the istibra, sometimes some people witness some fluids, basically quite similar to the urine.
Yes.
That kind of discharge that comes out or oozes out involuntarily. Is it, first of all, najis or pure, ritually impure, or pure? If one notices this problem by chance, you know, what's the rule about the prayer after, you know, seeing or, you know, such fluids, such discharge? And is it obligatory in the future to examine this wetness, which comes out involuntarily?
Well, we talked about istibra and the concept of istibra and what istibra is done for. As the object of istibra is to make sure that there is no urine left in the urinary passage. And anything that comes out after the istibra must be treated as pure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the question you raised, of course, the wetness or the moisture that comes out after doing istibra, you know, and when one has doubt or entertains doubt about whether it is urine or not, then it's not considered urine because you have already done istibra. And obviously, in all this, in any circumstance like this, if a person doubts whether the urine or whether the moisture he or she he, of course, because istibra is all for men, yes, not for women, mm-hmm, and women do not do and are not supposed to do istibra. Therefore, when a man doubts whether the moisture he has discharged is urine or not, in the event that he has already done istibra, then he should ignore his doubt and consider the fluid, mm-hmm, as pure, and therefore he can continue praying and performing any acts of obligation which require tahara.
I see. Would you please be kind enough to explain about the difference, different wetness or wet discharges that people see or individuals may experience?
Yeah, this is quite an interesting and also a very important question, because a lot of people do witness and see different kinds of fluids, and they do wonder as to what and how they should go about, right, those moisture. Of course, there are three types of fluids that, if discharged by men, they should be treated as pure. For example, the wetness that comes out occasionally after discharge of semen is called wadhi. Okay, and this is an Arabic word. Of course, we should acknowledge and the fact that Arabic is so vast when it comes to the words and the terms and expressions that it offers. So we have the word wad. There is no synonym for it. So we should learn the Arabic word. Wadhi is the fluid that comes after discharging semen, and that is pure. And there's also another kind of fluid that which comes occasionally after urinating, and that's called wadhi. Okay, so the spelling is different in the Arabic, but you know the pronunciation is very much they look to be the same, you know. And then there is another kind of moisture which comes out after foreplay, and that's called madhi. Madhi, okay. Some people pronounce it wrongly as mazi. Well, that's not the mm-hmm. case, because the true and the exact pronunciation is madhi. So all of these types of fluid seen by a man are pure, ritually pure,
yes,
and one should not have any doubt about them being on his body. And if these doubts appear, if one has doubts about such thing, then in the event that they fall under one of these three categories, they should be treated as pure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies.
Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.